Okay, I think we can start. The speaker today is Andrea Lapore, speaking about rainbows beyond gravity.
Yes, thank you. I would like to start by thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity of presenting this recent work that I've been doing in collaboration with Matt Diasanyussi and Professor Lewandowski. It has been uploaded, as you can see, very recently in December of the past year, and it has this fancy number, archive number 6000, I'm very proud of. So I also would like to thank the organizer for giving me this for letting me open the spring session of the Loop Quantum Gravity Seminar, although, of course, here in Warsaw, it doesn't look like spring at all yet, but still. The thing I will present today, as you can see from the title, it's Rainbows from Quantum Gravity. So a few words about the title. Well, the quantum gravity, I don't have to explain you what it is. However, I should mention that the results I'm presenting today are not really limited to loop quantum gravity, but as you will see, they are more general. I will be considering some formal features and use in no way any specific property of loop quantum gravity, Hilbert space, or operators. The important words, of course, is rainbows. So why I have to justify this word? So what I will present today, it's not only quantum gravity, but quantum gravity coupled to a scalar field, a quantum scalar field, and the result will be that this completely quantum theory of matter coupled to gravity, it's dynamically equivalent to a theory of a quantum field on a classical background, where the background depends on the mode of the field. So we have an energy-dependent semi-classical metric, and this justifies the word rainbow, because it's exactly what happens for light when light propagates into a refractive medium. You know very well that photons of different colors, of different wavelengths, follow different geodesics, different paths, and this generates the rainbow. Of course, I'm not the one inventing this word. There is plenty of work in the literature about rainbow metrics, except that such metrics in the literature usually are postulated. Instead, what I'm going to show you today, it's a way to for such energy-dependent metric to emerge from a fundamental quantum gravity theory. Okay, so let's go to slide number one. This is just the outline of the talk, so I will present the classical theory first, which I already mentioned what it is. It's just general relativity coupled to a scalar field. Then I will perform a formal quantization. So the operators I will be showing are just, you know, formal. So once you choose the specific theory of quantum gravity, then you will have to be sure that such operators are well defined. But this is our next step. Then the third part will be the main result. So how this classical effective metric, mode-dependent effective metric, emerges from the quantum theory. And then in the fourth part, we will study some phenomenology about this effective metric. Since the metric depends on energy, then we expect some Lorentz violations, so, or if you want, universality violations, so particles of different energies travel on different geodesics. So I will analyze some dispersion relations and stuff. And finally, the conclusion. So let's go to slide number two. Here is just an introduction. I already told you the general idea. We want to construct a quantum field theory on quantum space-time and then consider single modes of the quantum field and see how they probe this quantum geometry. Now, what do we expect to happen? Well, if we were in a classical space-time, so if we just build quantum field theory on a curved space-time, then we can say, in some broadly, some, you know, hand-wavingly speaking, that the state of geometry, it's actually an eigenstate of the metric, and so every mode of the field of the quantum field that we couple to it will live on this specific eigenstate. However, if we consider a quantum space-time, then we have rather a superposition of metric eigenvalues, so to speak, and then, you know, it is conceivable that modes of different quanta of different wave length, which I here denote by vector k, will live on, will feel different components of this infinite superposition, this infinite linear combination. So this is the wave, you know, hand waving idea of the talk, and I hope it will be clear it will be made more rigorous in the following. So let's go to slide number 3. Okay, this is the title of the section, Classical Theory. Next slide. Okay, so we start from a space-time manifold. Why I am considering a globally hyperbolic space-time, so we have this topologically splitting between, in a sense, time and the spatial slice, sigma. And I also will ask the topology of sigma to be a torus, a three torus, a box, basically, because, you know, since I am considering quantum field theory, I will be performing some Fourier transform, and then it's easier to consider this topology. One can always send the walls of the box at infinity, and then the sums will become integrals. One can consider different topology for sigma and expand on eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator in the given topology. But just to be specific, we will choose the three torus topology. Now, the theory that I will consider is given in equation 1. This is just the action. And as I already said, is gravity, minimally coupled to a scalar field. And notice that the scalar field, in principle, has a potential V. In the talk, I will consider just a simple mass. So this V will be just m squared phi squared. I don't expect that more complicated potential will remove the effect, the Lorentz violating effect you will see, in case they will make it even stronger. So in particular, inflatonic potential will probably make things worse rather than better. So anyway, considering this action, one performs canonical analysis. You all know very well what happens, that the metric becomes, let's say, it's expressed in terms of ADM variables, so the spatial metric and the spatial momentum. The Klein-Gordon field, it's described in terms of the field itself and its momentum. So every point gamma in the phase space, it's coordinatized by these functions. Of course, we know that of the phase space is physical. There are four constraints, the Hamiltonian and the vector constraints. And I'm not going to write them here explicitly because you all know them and they are not very enlightening at this point. So, of course, the idea would be to reduce all these degrees of freedom to the physical Hilbert space, so to solve the constraints, but this cannot be done. At least I'm not aware of anyone solving Hamiltonian general relativity at the complete level. So what we are going to do, we are going to consider linearized gravity. This is the first big approximation that I am considering. And it happens in the next slide. So let's go to slide number 5. Well, actually here I'm just presenting a choice of coordinates on the phase space. So you can see that these ADM variables are splitted into homogeneous and inhomogeneous parts. So if you want an example of what is homogeneous, you can look at equation 5. This is the definition of the homogeneous isotropic part of the metric. And, of course, it is related to the scale factor. But this, at this point, is just a kinematical splitting. I didn't impose any constraint yet. I didn't tell you that these delta functions, these quantities with delta in front are small. It's just a choice of coordinates on phase space. So, in particular, QAB0 does not satisfy any zeroth order Einstein equation or Friedmann equation whatsoever. Of course, what's going to happen in the next slide is that I'm plugging this decomposition into the constraints and then expand the constraints at the linear order. If you want a picture in the phase space, we are considering the subspace of the phase space of homogeneous data, and we are looking at what the constraints tell us in the neighborhood of this subspace. So, of course, when the constraints will be linearized, we will be able to solve them. So let's go to slide number 6. As I said, we solved the constraint at linear order. You can find...
Question.
Yes?
Can we go back to number 5? Yes. Is there a typo in this equation 5?
Mm-hmm.
We don't understand A squared is equal to delta.
Yes.
So delta is not a perturbation, is it?
No, delta...
I'm confused about...
Delta AB here, okay, is just the three metric, the metric of flat.
There's no perturbation there, okay.
No,
delta QAB is a perturbation. Thank you so much, okay.
Yes. So, slide number 6, after performing this reduction of the constraints at the linear level, you can find the computation in this paper by myself, Lewandowski and Puchta, we are left with the following physical degrees of freedom. So there is the homogeneous isotropic geometry, just the scale factor. There will be tensor modes of geometry, so to say gravitons, the two polarization of graviton, and there will be scalar modes of the field, of the scalar field, yes. Notice that here I already labeled the quantities by the inhomogeneities by vector k, so I already performed this expansion in plane waves, so basically the x dependence became k dependence, and of course now k takes values into a lattice, and in this lattice I am excluding the zero vector, because of course k equals zero corresponds to the homogeneous mode. So the homogeneous part of the geometry has been called scale factor A. And what about the homogeneous part of the scalar field? We are using it to solve the homogeneous part of the Hamiltonian constraint. So in this way, the phi zero, the homogeneous part of the scalar field, become our physical time, and the Hamiltonian constraint becomes a real physical Hamiltonian, which drives evolution. So if you want, this is just a gauge fixing, and you can see the gauge transformation in equation 6. So every function of the physical degrees of freedom depends on phi zero by this equation, where h physical is given in explicitly in equation 7. Now, why do I choose this specific time? To make the bridge with what happens, for example, in loop cosmology, where people only have scalar the scale factor and the homogeneous mode of the scalar field, and so they usually deparameterize the Hamiltonian constraint by the scalar field. So in this sense, the homogeneous sector of the theory I am working on will be consistent with what it's done in quantum cosmology. So let's take a look at the explicit form of equation 7 of the physical Hamiltonian. There is a homogeneous part, which only depends on homogeneous isotropic data, on the scale factor and its momentum, so it drives the evolution for the scale factor. And then there is a term in this Hamiltonian which is quadratic in the inhomogeneities of the scalar field. So in fact, it's an harmonic oscillator as far as the scalar field is concerned. However, the frequency of this scalar field, it not only depends on the mode k and on the mass m of the field, but also on the background geometry through the scale factor a and through this h homogeneous to minus 1. There is also similar term for the inhomogeneities for the gravitons, from the inhomogeneities of the gravity. However, I am going to disregard them because they just make the computations more messy, but they don't really change the result. So in the following, I'm going to focus only on this homogeneous geometry and this harmonic bunch of harmonic oscillators of inhomogeneities of the scalar field. Now, at this point, I would like you to notice that in particular A, the scale factor, the evolution of the scale factor is not only given by H hom, but in principle also from the other part, the quadratic term. However, in the next few slides, I will be assuming a background, so this also will disappear. So let's go to slide number 7. So I presented you the classical theory, and now I'm going to do this formal quantization. So let's go to question, yes?
Yes, can we go to slide number 6?
Yes.
So you are parameterizing your inhomogeneous degrees of freedom by two tensor modes and one scalar mode.
Yes.
But for the scalar mode, you use the perturbations of the scalar field. And we know that is gauge dependent. So yeah. In which gauge are you working? In other words, why you don't have curvature perturbations, scalar curvature perturbations also? Are you working in a gauge in a flat gauge in which we don't have perturbations of the metric scalars?
Okay, so we are working, I mean, so you mean perturbation of the scale factor? What? So we are certainly working in a specific gauge. We are not choosing Mukano-Sasaki variables for other reasons. But we're working in a specific gauge. I'm not sure I understand the question. So if you are interested in the specific features of this gauge, you can look at this paper. But so what exactly would you expect?
My statement is that this delta phi is a gauge-dependent variable, so you have to specify.
No, they are not. They are not.
The equation of motion.
They are not gauge-independent. We are working in a specific gauge.
And so I assume is what people cosmologists call the flat gauge, in which there is no scalar metric perturbation, because otherwise you would have another variable in the equation.
Okay. It might be. I'm not familiar with this terminology, but yes, it certainly, this is the full equation, that this is the Hamiltonian of the full theory, so yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So Let's go to to slide number 8. Okay, so this is the quantization, the formal quantization. As I said, we are focusing only on the matter part and the homogeneous degrees of freedom, the scale factor. So, as such, the Hilbert space of the theory is just a tensor product between this H homogeneous, which accounts basically for quantum cosmology, and then some other Hilbert space which contains the degrees of freedom of the inhomogeneities of the scalar field, which might or might not be a Fock space. This it's up to your favorite theory of quantum gravity. So for me, I just require these Hilbert spaces to be well defined. Then on these Hilbert spaces, I can define the physical Hamiltonian operator, which is the equation 9, and it's given, of course, by just putting the hats, so to speak, on the previous equation. So there is the homogeneous part, which only acts on the non-trivially on the H homogeneous, and then the other part, which acts both in the H homogeneous and in H phi. And here I also am defining this new operator big omega, just to simplify the notation. And you can see I'm taking some symmetrization, but you know you are free to choose a different one. This is just for you know, consistency reason. So what I do once I have this Hamiltonian operator, I can consider the most general state in this Hilbert space, which I remind you would be a function of time, so the value of the homogeneous mode of the scalar field. It would be a function, let's say, of the scale factor, I mean the eigenvalue of the scale factor operator, and then of some other another bunch of variables denoting the degrees of freedom of the scalar field, which I call just phi globally to simplify. And and of course this Hamiltonian will describe the evolution, will define the evolution, the quantum evolution of this state by the Schrödinger equation, which is equation 11. Now at this point, in principle, this is the quantum theory, and I cannot do much more until I choose some specific Hilbert space and some specific operators. But since we want to stay general, then we have to take some approximation in order to go on. So this happens in the next slide, number 9. This is called the second and last approximation of the talk, and it's the so-called test field approximation, also in a sense is the zeroth order Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which basically means that the geometry does not feel the back reaction of matter. So what do I mean by this? If you think about modeling a hydrogen atom, when you want to describe both the electron and the proton in terms of a quantum wave function, then usually you can always argue that the proton is much heavier than the electron, and hence it will not feel the presence of the electron, whereas instead the electron in its Hamiltonian, it will feature some potential due to the wave function of the proton. And this is exactly what's happening for us. So we are, in a sense, our proton is the quantum geometry, this background geometry, which I here call psi 0 in equation 12. And our electron will be the matter part, which is this little phi. What do I mean? So first of all, they are disentangled during all the evolution. And secondly, the quantum geometry part evolves in this just with the zeroth order Hamiltonian. So this is what I was saying, that it only evolves with the homogeneous part of the Hamiltonian. So it doesn't know anything about these inhomogeneities of the scalar field. Now, if you take this splitting, this specific ansatz, if you want, or approximation, and you plug it into the complete Schrödinger equation of the previous slide, and then you trace away the degrees of freedom of quantum geometry, what you obtain is equation 14. It's an equation only for scalar field. So, of course, as you expect, it's again a harmonic oscillator, but now this frequency, these parameters of the harmonic oscillators are not just simple function or classical objects, but they are in fact expectation values of geometric operators on the quantum state of geometry psi 0, quantum state of cosmology, if you want. So for me, it's already interesting to notice that in spite of the huge complexity that you can choose for psi 0, it's enough to just compute these two expectation values for these two operators to know exactly what is the evolution of the scalar field in this quantum space time. Okay, so
could we stop for a minute and go back a little bit? Sorry, it was a little bit faster. In the classical theory, you said that you're using the scalar field as the internal time.
Yes.
And you even wrote down the equation for the evolution of various things, like equation 6, for example.
Yes.
But then when you go to the quantum theory, you just about equation 11 on slide 8, you have a wave function which depends both on phi and t. And what is this t now?
No, no, t is the value of... Okay, it's actually phi 0. I'm just changing notation, but it's the value of phi 0.
Phi 0, and phi is delta phi, or?
Yes, yes, I'm sorry. I mean, phi, it's in above equation 11, phi is just a generic variable to denote somehow this infinitely many harmonic oscillators. In fact, I don't think we should say infinitely many harmonic oscillators. Let's say a finite number of harmonic oscillators. So there would be delta phi k for various number values of k, let's say.
So phi is really delta phi k, and t is phi
yes.
naught.
Yes, exactly.
Okay,
sorry.
Thank you.
Okay, so thank you for pointing out this possible confusion. Okay, so this we are at slide 9. This is basically the quantum theory, so one can just look at this equation and you know study how it's how it behaves once some operators, some quantum cosmology has been chosen, some quantum state psi zero has been chosen. But what we want to do is exactly the main result is to show this effective space-time. So let's go to slide number 10. This is okay, the title, effective metric. So next slide, number 11. Now, first, this equation 15 is just the one we just derived, this evolution for the quantum field theory in a quantum space-time where I when I averaged the quantum nature of the space-time. And now suppose I give you a completely different problem. I tell you consider a metric of the Robinson-Walker type, so a classical curved background like equation 16. Now the laps and the shift, the laps and the scale factor have not this n bar and a bar have nothing to do with anything I've seen before. And I tell you, let's build quantum field theory on this for a quantum field, for a scalar field with a mass m, on this specific curved spacetime. Well, it turns out, if you take a book of quantum field theory in curved spacetime, that the Schrödinger equation for the modes of such quantum field theory on this curved background, it's exactly what is in 17. Now, 17 and 15, in principle, have nothing to do with each other. However, if you look at them, they are really, really similar. And if you allow me to put the blue thing, the blue part of 15 equal to the blue part of 17, and the green part of 15 equal to the green part of 17, which is basically what's written in this system of two equations, then the two equations 15 and 17 really coincide. So what I'm saying here is that if instead of giving you a general Robinson-Walker spacetime with a generic n bar and a bar, I give you as a Robinson-Walker spacetime with n bar and a bar satisfying, solving this system of two equations, then the quantum field theory on this curved background that you construct, it's exactly equivalent, dynamically equivalent, to the quantum field, if you want, the fundamental quantum field theory on quantum space-time. So this is how this effective metric emerges. So now, of course, the first equation of this system is easily solved, so you see that n bar is a simple function of a bar. However, when you plug this result in the second equation, then you get a third-order algebra, I mean sixth-order, which can be reduced to third-order algebraic equation, which in general has no real solution, or, you know, it may not have a good solution. So, but one thing we are sure of is that it depends on k and on m. It explicitly depends on the mode and on the mass. And so in equation 18, I write it implicitly as A equal A or K over M. Actually, we are very lucky. Yes, please.
I would like to stop because to me, this is a critical point up here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had discussed this before, I think, Jurek and you and I.
Yes.
But, I mean, I agree that if you make this particular ansatz of comparison, then you would get A bar to be a function of K and M, right? And that's as you wrote down.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also make, and if you're even more reasonable, an ansatz that these quantum corrections, what they do is not only, so to say, dress the metric, but also dress the potential.
Yes.
There's no reason to believe that the potential should be, again, exactly mass squared times some dress scale factor. You could just say that you've got a new potential, an effective potential there.
Yes.
And if you do that, then the statement is, if you like, there is a new degree of freedom, which is this finding the effective potential.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is that your quantum equation, which is 15, and you're comparing with a classical equation, which is 17. And in the classical equation, you only allow the scale factor to change and not the potential of the
mass. Yes, you're right.
And so where there are two options, and if I took the second option, then I don't need A bar to become a function of K. You agree with that, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So to me, the Rainbow metric is really a consequence of a third assumption, which is that the effective Brecht classical description only changes the metric and does not change the potential that the scalar field has. That is the third assumption that goes into
the derivation. Yes, you are right. There is this extra assumption that we do not, in a sense, we do not renormalize the mass, the potential. That is certainly true. My understanding, of course, I don't have a proof of this, but I would expect that the physics of the two, so we are choosing two different ansatz, getting two apparently different results, but I would expect that the physics should be the same, because in both cases, the fundamental equation 15 is satisfied. So,
except that in the, looking at it, that you have addressed, it depends on what you mean by physics, right? I mean, how you extract the physics. Because if you just have a Brecht potential, then there is no Rainbow metric, and therefore there is no Lorentz violation whatsoever. Exactly, there is no Lorentz violation at all.
Yes,
so I agree that physics is the same, but your interpretation of what physics is telling us critically depends on what one does here.
Yes, I agree.
Can I ask a question as well, Amir? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So what about if you consider gravitons? Because then you don't have the problem with the potential. You have something which is much cleaner as a test for whether it's the metric that's scale-dependent or the potential.
Yeah, so for the graviton, there is no mass term, and then there is no effective Rainbow metric either.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is that true?
Yes. That is correct. Professor Ashtekar knows this stuff very well. So, in fact, what he's saying is correct, and we already discussed this. So he's certainly right. Okay, go ahead.
You're saying that tensor modes don't feel a Rainbow metric, but scalar modes do.
Right. Yeah, yes.
Question. When you say about that you would modify the potential, this is working just to quadratic order in the fluctuations of the scalar field. And why would we modify a potential which involves terms of higher order in the fluctuations of the scalar field? We could just be doing free field theory for the scalar field.
That is what the conduct statement is. Exactly the same equations that are being written down here, 15 and 17. The statement is that you are comparing, except that in the 17, you are just writing a certain potential. These modes are propagating in a certain geometry, right? And there is a potential, of course, for this force, because m squared phi squared is a potential. And the statement is that we are just asking, what is the effective description when you write it as though it is really propagating on a classical background? And as Andrea very nicely explained to us, it is very surprising that you can just choose an effective classical background and get the propagation on the quantum geometry and in presence of this potential to be exactly the same as that on the classical background. And now the statement is that there is mathematical fact that you can just change the classical geometry and also the potential. If there is no potential, then there's only classical geometry which changes, and then there's no Rainbow metric whatsoever. Okay? So if m is equal to zero, then there's no Rainbow metric. Now we're at a potential. So it's natural.
I want to add to a Abhay's comment that if you do that, if you include a potential and consider the effective potential, the effective metric that a scalar perturbation field is exactly the same as the one a tensor perturbation field without, and they don't have potential. So I think that is an important comment related to Joao's previous comment.
Okay.
Okay, but if you take an operational point of view, if you're measuring the quanta, these modes of the scalar field, propagating, and you're measuring their energy and momentum, you would get a different energy. It can't be a matter of interpretation of the equations, because the effect that they're predicting is that you get a different relation between the wavelength and the frequency of the modes of the scalar field coming from the modified energy momentum relation. So how can that depend on a choice as to where one identifies the term?
It's because the relation between the symbols in the equations and what you call about your measurement of mass does depend on the you have to set up a dictionary there, right?
So do you agree that his interpretation is possible and there's another interpretation of the same phenomenology, or do you claim that his interpretation is incorrect? Is it possible to interpret the phenomenology that we got
Sorry, is the speaker
as a scalar mode propagating in a dependent background metric? I think it's sufficient that the interpretation is consistent. It doesn't matter if there's a different interpretation.
It's good that people are discussing. Okay.
I think the mathematics, I completely agree. But then when it comes to actually interpreting in terms of measurement and so on, we have to be much, much more careful. And there I would probably disagree. And at the important point that Ivan just made, which is that with the potential there, the fact that the scalar and the tensor modes see exactly the same stress metric is an important consideration in all these things. I mean, it would be funny, right? I mean, because it's a coupled system. Anyway, so to me, that is a strong point Ivan made is a strong point. But I think we can go on. I mean, there's nothing, I mean, we should pursue this much more detail. I just wanted to raise an important point at this juncture, and we should discuss this perhaps again at that.
Yes, sir. I thank you both for the discussion, but maybe we can. I should first finish, and then we can leave the discussion for the end. But I'm very happy that there is a there is interest in this problem, because it's not clear for me either. So, but maybe I would go on now. Okay. So, right. So assuming that we take the specific ansatz of Robinson Walker spacetime without renormalizing or without redefining the mass term, the potential term, then we have this system of equations, and indeed it turns out that this system can be solved. There is a unique A bar solution, and it's given in the next slide number 12. So here again I remark that the fundamental quantum gravity plus quantum matter is equivalent to quantum field theory on effective k-dependent spacetime. And where is this k-dependence? It's written in 19. So you can see here is this scale factor squared. And it's not a simple function, but it is analytic. It is given by two different, it has two different forms for a threshold, you know, for k smaller than a threshold value, k0, certain form, and for k bigger than k0, another form. But one can check that they match smoothly at k equal k0. And so we have a unique positive solution for every value of k, so from 0 to infinity.
I have a comment here, because in the equation 19, you have a term which is k squared over m squared.
Yes.
But in a flat Friedman, Robertson, Walker spacetime, k doesn't have any physical meaning.
No.
K is the commutative k.
Not yet. K at this point is just the parameter of the Fourier expansion. It will have a physical meaning probably in the next slide. So
right, but you know, I can rescale k freely in my theory, and obviously, equation 19 is telling to me that then the scale factor is going to change. So what is the meaning of that?
Okay, I don't know. I mean, the physics, what I can understand from here, it will come when I start. Considering, for example, dispersion relation of particles in this specific scale factor, in this specific metric, and then the physical particle, I mean, the you will see what its physical momentum and physical energy, at least as far as my understanding goes. But for now, it's just the way it is. I mean, it's just a solution of this equation. There's probably nothing very enlightening about it. So, okay, there is one comment I should do, that it's that the case of massless potential, so if I started again from the beginning with mass equal to zero, was studied in 2009 by Ashtek, Kaminsky, and Lewandowski, and the result is 21. It is independent of K this time, and but it's in agreement with our solution 19, in the sense that if we take a mass much smaller than this K, then, so basically mass equal to zero, then indeed we recover this this massless result. So there is consistency with the massless case. Okay, so now let's go to slide number 13. Here I am considering for simplicity, as I said, this solution that, of equation 19, it's exact, it's analytical, so one could work with it. But just for simplicity, for just to be able to write equations on the slides, I will take this limit, this k much smaller than m. So if you want, okay, there is no real physical meaning of k yet. But, well, as you can see in expansion 22, you see that there is this a zero, so there is a zeroth order scale factor, and then there is this correction in which it's not k, but k over a zero bar. And this is the quantity that has physical meaning of momentum in our space-time. So this k over a zero bar is really the momentum of the particle. And so what we are saying here is that we are making an expansion for k over a zero bar much smaller than m. Now, this is the form of this expansion. You can see that there is this zero-order scale factor, and there is the first correction, which is quadratic in the momentum over the mass, is controlled by this parameter beta. So what is the interpretation of these two parameters? Well, a zero will just be what I would call the classical metric or semi-classical metric, because this would be the metric measured, the scale factor, let's say, measured by an experimentalist, by a cosmological observer, which makes experiments with throwing around objects, studying the geodesic of particles, which have very, very big mass compared to their momentum. This is the case of macroscopic objects. So let's say that a macroscopic observer would really measure, would think that the metric is a zero, is this g0 mu nu in 23. On the other hand, the parameter that controls the correction, the error that this observer does, is beta. And you can see that beta contains really information about the non-classicality of the background space-time. So this expression, I mean, in these expectation values, I'm not writing psi zero anymore, but of course these are quantum operators on the geometric part of the Hilbert space. And you can see that if the state is very peaked, if the state of the quantum cosmology, of the quantum gravity, is very peaked, then we can replace the expectation value of product of operators with the product of expectation value of operators, and in that case beta is equal to zero. So indeed, if the state were completely classical, then beta would be zero, okay? Of course, there would be a minimum value for beta given by the non-commutation relations, but in general, beta very small means classical, semi-classical state of quantum geometry. Okay, so indeed, in this way, we see where the quantum geometry plays a role in the correction to the zeroth order, if you want. So let's go to slide number 14. Okay, so I've shown you a bit this effective metric, how it emerges, and what are the conditions under which we obtain such a description of the fundamental quantum theory of the scalar field on quantum background. And now, since this metric seems to depend explicitly on the momentum of the particles of the mode, then we can expect some universality violations or Lorentz violations. So I'm gonna study this in the next section. So let's go to slide number 15. Now here to give some physical meaning to the quantities that I've been describing, I need to decide in which coordinates I am expressing all this stuff. So let's say that I am a cosmological observer. I'm moving along a world line, and so the tangent to this world line, the four velocity, is u mu. Since I am a classical observer, I think I live in a metric g bar zero mu nu. And suppose that a particle, a not necessarily low energetic particle, crosses my laboratory and it has a momentum, a momentum k mu. What is the physical energy that I measure? It's the projection of this four momentum on my four velocity, right? And you can see if in my coordinate, in the cosmologic, in the moving coordinates of this observer, they are just the time part of the four momentum over n zero bar. What about the momentum? This will be the momentum that I measure of this particle is the orthogonal projection of this k mu. which turns out, as I was saying before, to be just k over a zero bar. Now, so these are the physical quantities that I measure. However, the particle itself will have to satisfy the mass-shell relation in the real metric, I mean, in the complete metric, in the effective metric g bar without any low-energy approximation. So in equation 24, the first equality is exactly the Lorentz the mass-shell relation for the particle. Then I write, in the second equality, I write this term explicitly in my coordinates. And then in the third equality, I introduce this function, this rainbow function, f and g, which were first introduced by Magaja and Smolin in 2004. And so you can see that now I can solve equation 24 for e, and I get a modified dispersion relation. This is the first equality of 26. So, of course, I would recover the standard dispersion relation if f and g were equal to 1. But look at 25. F and g are equal to 1 exactly when n bar is equal to n0 bar and when a bar is equal to a0 bar, which is the case for a particle for which p is much smaller than m. So a very low energetic or a particle which, a macroscopic object, let's say. Now, in the second equality of 26, you can see the explicit form when I plug in the specific values of f and g for my solution, for this a bar that we computed. And you see that, in fact, this modification is really simple. It's just shifting a bit the term of the p-square term. There are, of course, higher orders, but since we are in this approximation for p much smaller than m, we can disregard them. Now, let's go.
Question.
Yes?
Question.
Yes?
Where is the Fock mass in these modified dispersion relations?
Excuse me, I didn't hear. Where is the?
What is the?
You've computed the quantum gravity effect, but I don't see. I see k squared over m squared, but I don't see the Planck mass in the equation.
The quantum gravity. Oh, the Planck length. Oh, very good. That's a very good observation. Thank you. In fact, there is no Planck length at all. It's one of our results. It's that, contrary to what people claim in the context of rainbow gravities, it seems that there is no real import. I will make this comment probably in the next slide, but it's a good point that it has been pointed out. We don't see any Planck energy, Planck length. It seems that this deviation is not controlled by Planck energy, but rather by this beta, which, of course, beta may have, you know, for some reason, for some specific states, beta might be of that order. But in principle, we don't see this. So let me go to slide number 16, and this the remark at the end of slide number... Yes?
Just a clarification. Beta is a dimensionless number, not a function of anything?
Beta? Beta is a dimensionless number.
Beta. So all this is affected to this order is a redefinition of the speed of light.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
The change of the coordinates that you would use to define the speed of light. You just have, in other words, you could just change the definition of the speed of light by 1 plus beta, and you would have the normal special relativity.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand that. The audio is not very clear. If someone can if someone can hear better, can they repeat the question maybe?
So I could also comment on that. I think the claim is that beta is a constant. This is just a redefinition of the speed of light. I think beta
a redefinition of the speed of light, yes. Yes, that's true. So if you wait a second and you go to the next slide, you will see all these comments. But maybe the one about the speed of light is the next, the second to next. So, but yes, this I just want to mention now that this simple modification is just so simple because we took this low energy limit. If I started from the full a bar of equation 19, then we would have something much more complicated than this. So for simple reasons, I just did this simplification, but you will see at the end I will show some plot for the full scale factor, for the full effective metric, and the modification is much more clear. But anyway, beta it's a function of expectation values of quantum operators on the state of quantum geometry. So at least it depends on time. So it is indeed a redefinition of the speed of light, but it's not a constant anymore. But let's let me go to slide 16, and I'm showing you a bit of, you know, these two questions that they have been asked about the Planck energy and about the speed of light. Hopefully, I will address them now. So in equation 16, there is, I just repeat in equation 27, I just repeat the form of this dispersion relation. You can notice that you recover the standard dispersion relation in two independent limits. There is the limit of classical matter, so very low energetic particles. Of course, you get E equal mc square, I mean, C equal 1 in this case. So that's a good result, of course. And the semi-classical gravity limit, where, as I said, the state of geometry is very peaked, so beta is very much smaller than 1, and so you recover the standard dispersion relation. However, and this is as far as the Planck energy is concerned, notice, so in this plot, I'm showing the two cases. In the green line is the classical, basically, the classical dispersion relation, the hyperbola. And the blue one, it's a very quantum state, so we just choose beta equal to 0.2. It's very close to the unity, so it's a very important modification. And you can see that the deviation between the two dispersion relations, between the two functions, it's already seen for P over M equal to 1. P over M equal to 1 means that particles which have an energy of order of their mass, for example, for a proton would be 1 gigaelectron volt, already should see such deviation. But of course, nowadays we make experiments at tera electron volts in accelerators, so we don't see such Lorentz deviations. Why is that? Because beta is much smaller than 0.2 nowadays. Hopefully, our geometry is classical today, and so that's why we don't see such effect. But in principle, if your state, if your beta is big enough, then you can see deviation already at energies of the order of the Compton length, basically, of particles. So I don't see any reason to introduce Planck energy at any point. Of course, if beta is such that the deviation will be important at Planck energy, then okay, this is the case. But in principle, beta will be depending on your state, on your state psi zero. So this is a major result that we see, that there is no Planck energy in any... I don't see how it could emerge anywhere. Now, for the second comment, let's go to slide number 17. Here I compute the velocity of particles in this approximation, in this case. And you can immediately see that for m much smaller than p, so exactly for massless particles, you just get a slight modification of the speed of light. Instead of 1, you get square root of 1 plus beta. So as Lee was saying, we just redefine the speed of light and we are done. Well, not really, because first of all, beta, I remind you, it's a function of time. It's an expectation value of geometric operators on some psi zero, which does evolve on time. So this beta changes in time. So this is a definition of speed of light, which changes in time. And not only this, but also the fact that there is no direct dependence on the momentum p is just due to our very crude approximation when at the level of equation 19, I was saying, oh, this is too complicated the form, so let's make this low energy approximation. So now the plot in this slide 17 shows actually the numerics for the full A bar, for the full dressed effective metric, and you can see the dotted blue line are the velocity of light for this quantum case beta equal to 0.2, and you can see that indeed it depends on p, at least from between 0 and 2. So there is it's not a trivial just a shift in the speed of light. Again, you notice from the plot that the deviation is obvious, is very clear, and again the solution of the why we don't see such deviation is because today we don't have beta equal 0.2, but rather beta equal to 0. Interesting thing to notice is that although there is indeed a change, I mean the speed of light depends on energy, and so it's really modified, but still massive particles, which are the continuous lines, are always slower than the speed of light, so at least the causality is satisfied. So you have light cones are deformed, if you want, but there is never propagation of matter, of massive particles faster than, outside the light cone. So at least that is a good result. And I think that this is what I wanted to say, so let me just briefly go to slide 19, the conclusions. So again, main result of which we are pretty sure is that we can describe quantum gravity plus quantum matter in terms of quantum field theory on an effective k-dependent spacetime. Of course, this is true if you assume the specific assumptions that I gave, so this linearized inhomogeneities around homogeneous isotropic background, the test field approximation, and as as Abai says, also this specific ansatz of not renormalizing the potential. So in these assumptions, we discover that that there is a k-dependence, so there is a, indeed a rainbow metric emerging. What are the effects of this dependence? I show you that there is this modified dispersion relation, and it's not controlled by Planck energy, but rather by this beta parameter, which encodes the non-classicality of the underlying quantum background, quantum space-time, basically. And notice that, in fact, the quantum space-time can be very complicated, but we just need one single parameter beta to start to parameterize these deformations. And this is very similar to what happens, as I was saying at the beginning, in refractive materials, where despite of the huge complexity of interaction between electrons and photons, still you can describe at the macroscopic level the propagation of light into refractive media just by the use of a refractive index and a single parameter. So this is interesting, I think. Maybe it's more deep than what we think. And finally, can we test this result? Well, probably not today, because as I said, today beta is very, very small, and so even for high energy particles, this parameter will kill every deformation, so no way of testing Lorentz violation today. But maybe in the primordial universe, although there are some results, at least in quantum cosmology, that show that actually the state remains semi-classical, remains peaked through the bounds, but well, one can imagine maybe in other approaches to quantum cosmology that very close to the Big Bang or to the Big Bounds, the state is not so classical anymore, so maybe beta is big, and so at that point even particles is an even low energy particle will feel such Lorentz violation, and it would be nice to understand what is the effect of such Lorentz violation in the pre-inflationary universe, for example. So anyway, thank you very much.
Questions?
Maybe in the other order. First, to the extent that this is a version of rainbow gravity, as Jean-Marie and I wrote it down with the F with modification of the energy momentum relations with the functions F and the function G, multiplying the energy and momentum, it's not a breaking of the Lorentz invariance, it's a deformation of the Lorentz invariance. That is, the linearized theory that describes the propagation is still invariant under a 6-parameter Lorentz group, but it's the action of the Lorentz group on energy momentum state has an additional dependence on energy momentum over the linear transformation. So it's properly called it the deformation of the Lorentz invariant. As far as the testability, so this is the leading order effect of beta, would be, if I understand you right, A dependent to its definition here in equation 29. And as such, there are probably good limits on data, on data's A-dependence, scale factor dependence, from measurements of spectral lines in quasar absorption lines, in charge of quasar absorption lines. I think they're on the order of applying 10 to the fifth. So data could be bounded pretty effectively already by President Sarna.
Hi, this is Jurek. I would like to comment on beta. Probably I'm replying to Lee's question, but this also refers to the previous question about beta. So actually beta obviously contains h-bar, because as we can see, beta is given by expectation values of products of operators, and if those operators were all commuting, then beta would be zero, but this is not the case. They don't commute, and the commutators are somehow proportional to h bar. And obviously, depending on specific quantum representation of those classical functions, we have some specific value for beta. So h bar is sitting there in some way which was for us difficult to explicitly calculate, but obviously h bar is there.
Okay.
And I would like also to answer to Abai. So as Abai said that the key point is when we are looking for the effective classical metric to replace the coefficients in quantum equations for a quantum mode, that we are assuming that we will obtain equations for a mode which has the same mass parameter, and the only thing which changes is that metric. I mean that we adopt only metric. We don't adopt potential or we don't change mass. So yes, this is exactly what we do. But I wouldn't call it an assumption. I would call it just mathematical fact that you can replace those. You can find such effective metric actually exactly, because otherwise, if you renormalize, then you may try to hide some terms you don't want to in mass, and then replace it by some constant, even though originally it was not a constant. But in our case, we don't have to do such sophisticated techniques. We just mathematically have equivalence between two systems just by assuming that the mass was the same and that the metric, classical metric tensor was found.
Can you clarify something again? Just looking at equation 29 again. So you say that beta, the difference between that expression and 1, which gives beta, it comes from commutators between the pi, the operator for the scale factor, and the operator for the momentum, which is in the definition of H. Don't those have a factor of root constant in them, as well as H bar?
Yes, because these are commutators of functions which don't, whose Poisson bracket is not zero.
So beta does have the constant in it somehow.
So what I mean is that, I mean, it's not exactly true that this beta is an exact function of h bar, but if we now ask what is a minimal possible non-zero value, then we will obtain some bounds, which are, then we'll find that beta is bounded by commutators between those operators, like in the usual Heisenberg uncertainty relation. We know that this is just inequality. So in our case, we can probably, given some, so probably we could given some specific cases, we could find some inequalities for beta, that beta is bounded by something, and then this bound will depend on h bar.
And then
I have a couple of comments here. First of all, I want to thank Andrea very much for this beautiful talk he gave. And I want to go back to this issue about the changing just the metric or the potential. So first of all, I mean, supposing we did not start with just m squared phi squared, we just started with some, you know, small hilltop potential or something, then this procedure cannot be repeated, just because in this procedure one keeps m the same. And in that general potential, there is no m. And so what happens is, of course, in generally, the potential is going to be modified. And then, again, there is no rainbow metric. We don't need a rainbow metric. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that by just using the rainbow metric, you could not accommodate the changes that would actually happen when the general potential is stressed. Here, you've got a guidance, because there is only m and m squared phi squared, so you keep m the same and try to change everything else. In general, you don't have that guidance.
No, but I would expect, sorry if I interrupt, but I would expect that in the inclusion, if I include also a potential, like a platonic potential, the effective metric would actually also depend on that potential. If I proceed according to my ansatz without modifying the potential, just there will be an extra term in this system. No, in the system there will still be two equations. There would still be two equations of in the system. Just this the left hand side of the system of the second equation would also contain lambda. The parameter of the fourth or of the 5-4 to the four. This is my expectation.
The potential I don't define to the four. It doesn't have even a single constant, right? We can discuss this more.
Yes, certainly.
My statement is basically that in general, this procedure of putting everything in the metric is not really possible. That's what I'm claiming. Okay, so we'll discuss it later because the potential may have many parameters. And also, if it is not quadratic, then this Fourier transform technique really doesn't work, right? I mean, but okay, so that's separate. That's one remark that I would like to make, is just a mathematical remark. But more interestingly, if you just consider m squared, phi squared, even in this case. Mm-hmm. So, as Andrea pointed out, that the description should be somehow, in this particular case, should be mathematically equivalent. And I completely agree with it. You can either modify the potential, or you can say that you've got a rainbow metric in the m squared phi squared case, right? So therefore, we can just look at the effective theory, which is just a classical theory. It has h-bar in various terms, but there are no quantum states. It's just a classical theory, right? In other words, a field... I'm sorry. What I mean is that you don't have a quantum geometry. You just have quantum fields propagating on a classical background.
Right, yes.
So as far as the background is concerned, it is a classical theory. Okay, so then we'll get two descriptions. One in which you get some effective metric and a potential. And that is, just standard equation, no rainbow metric, so perfectly Lorentz invariant description. And the other description would be that there is actually a rainbow metric and there is going to be the scale factor, which depends on the scale, right? And so we can forget about quantum gravity altogether. We can just look at the classical issue. And what is just saying that if a field is propagating, a quantum field is propagating, quantum field with a certain potential is propagating on a classical space-time, so the whole thing is completely locally Lorentz invariant. Mm-hmm. But if I insist on saying that, in fact, that potential be replaced by m squared, phi squared, if you like, then I would get a rainbow metric. So this is a pure statement about mathematics of classical field theory. Mm-hmm. And I would like to know if Li and Zhao actually would call this emergence of just rewriting the equation, just quantum fields propagating on a classical background with the potential, converting it to a rainbow metric as kind of an important physical effect, or it is just a mathematical transformation. Would you say that the physics actually changes? Would you say that one would actually find in principle Lorentz invariant violating effects in a theory which is just the block of phi plus u of phi is equal to zero, or v of phi equal to zero, where v is the potential up there, right? So I would like,
our
V prime of phi equal to zero. I would like to understand your views on this.
So I would go further. I'm going to point out one thing, and I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, but I would go further and say that the effects in question can be captured not just taking mu constant to zero, but taking Planck constant to zero as well, so it descends to relativistic particle mechanics. But however, taking h bar to zero and g nu to zero in such a way that the ratio, which is the Planck mass squared, is fixed. That is, I think we would claim that all the physical effects at this order are captured in an effective theory, which is a modification of classical particle physics on a space time, which is a function of the speed of light and ratios of energy for the Planck energy. Now, in that context, the question is whether an effect which would be And a second statement is that in that context, if you work in effective theory defined in that limit, then the effects can be parameterized by deforming the geometry of momentum space. So that's just because of the way that the Planck mass occurs in the equation, that everything can be comprehended by modifying either the metric or the connection on momentum space. So then the question is, can you make an equivalent description in which you change the interactions of the particles rather than deform the geometry of momentum space? And that's an interesting question. I would have to think about it. I guess that what I said, Carla, was not helpful, but that's the way I would approach it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to approach it. But one can just ask this question just as quantum fields propagating on a classical space-time with a certain potential. And mathematically, I can rewrite it as a quantum field propagating on a rainbow metric with just a mass term for the potential. And the statement that I would like to ask, the question I would like to ask is that in this case, at least I would not say that, I would say this is mathematical rewriting, but I wouldn't say that there is Lorentz violation. I'm talking about an issue of principle. The second thing is that Andrea very nicely pointed out that, you know, if you choose beta small enough because of the state of the background geometry such that beta is very small, then we would not see this direct effect in the Lorentz violation effect in the laboratory. But there's a very detailed analysis by John Collins, Alejandro Perez, Daniel Sudarsky, and followed by many other people, which shows that even if there is a tiny violation, right, at the Planck scale, so to say, because of loop effects, it does trickle down to low energy physics once you introduce interactions.
Yeah.
And so I'm not saying that argument clearly applies to this particular case, but one has to re-examine that argument. That is something that one should be concerned with. Namely, once the interactions are included, will these effects trickle down to low energy?
Here's what confuses me about the whole question of data. If at the end of the calculation, we took the theory just to flat space time, with no variation in the scale factor, then beta would be entirely just a mathematical renormalization of a number that represents the speed of light, and there would be no physical effect at all. It would just be an effect that you had to renormalize the value of the speed of light at that point in the calculation. So the entire interest, the entire possible physical effect comes from their starting point in quantum field theory in an expanding universe on the Friedman-Robinson-Walker universe. And the possibility that the coefficients of the terms in the angular momentum relations depend on the scale factor in cosmology. And I'm not sure how that is or isn't addressed by, there is the analysis that is certainly right in flat space perturbation theory, which you quoted with John Collins and colleagues, that once you introduce changing the coefficient of t squared and e squared equals t squared plus m squared is a strong effect. It's a dimension 2 operator. And once you introduce even a tiny dimension 2 operator in a quantum field theory, its effects accumulate in loop effects and cause huge effects at dimension 4. So the extent to which that argument is valid, you have good evidence for the Lorentz invariance at the square level of dimension 2 operators. You have very strong evidence for the Lorentz invariance at the square level of dimension 2 operators.
More questions?
I have a question for Andrea.
Mm-hmm.
So you started with the field, the scalar field in position space, then you went to momentum space,
yes,
and then you proved that, you know, that with this assumption that we have been discussing, one can reinterpret, and when back reaction is negligible, one can reinterpret the dynamics of these fields as propagating an effective space-time which is k-dependent.
Yes.
But now my question is, can you take that theory, that quantum field theory, on a classical space-time, which is this trace-effective metric, can you come back to position space? So can you define a theory, for instance, commutation relations between operators, for instance, the commutation of the field operator at a given space-time point with same operator at a different space-time point? Can you show that this commutator is given by the retarded minus advanced Green functions, which are zero when the points are separated by a space-like interval? Because, you know, I am confused because the metric that you are defining is k-dependent. So how do you make sense of the theory in position space, which is what really you started with from the very beginning?
Right. So, I mean, certainly this is a good question and it's a concern, but I'm afraid I'm not really an expert really about this rainbow metrics, but it's, so maybe this question should be addressed to the founder of this doubly special relativity. But my understanding is indeed that there is, it's not so clear how to, I mean, at least for me, it's not, okay, what I'm trying to say is that probably the, if you want to give let's say, description of this theory in terms of a differential geometry, then this is not going to be a standard, a simple differential manifold. For example, the tangent space is not really flat. So yeah, I'm not sure how to interpret this position space. I mean, this relation between position and momentum space. But I'm sure that people who know this type of geometries, this energy dependent geometries, they know how to do that.
Thank you.
Just a comment. I think the obvious fact is that there's not going to be a factorization between position space and momentum space. But that's something which is usually obvious if you cannot untangle it. If you change the units and you try to untangle it, normally you get non-trivial effects somewhere else. The thing which I think is puzzling here is the fact exactly that the gravitons don't feel anything about this. I mean, you might say it's a bimetric structure in which you have a metric for the gravitons, which is not rainbow, and a metric for scalars, which is rainbow. But it's very strange, because normally it seems that it's something you can untangle very easily, just by redefining the potential. And I think that's basically what creates the impression this is trivial. I mean, you can always say, oh, I changed the units, therefore all these issues disappear. But, I mean, usually that means a lot of mess somewhere else. Here it doesn't seem to affect everything else. And I think that's the telltale signature that might be a problem in terms of physical interpretation.
Hmm. Yes, so I'm not sure.
More questions? Okay, let's thank Andrea again.